After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. But Abram said, O Lord God, what wilt thou give me? For I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. And Abram said, Behold, thou hast given me no offspring, and a slave born in my house will be my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, This man shall not be your heir, your own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, Look toward heaven and number the stars, if you are able to number them. Then he said to him, So shall your descendants be. And he believed the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you from Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess. But he said, O Lord God, how am I to know that I shall possess it? He said to him, Bring me a heifer 3 years old, a she-goat 3 years old, a ram 3 years old, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he brought them all these, cut them in two, and laid each half over against the other. And he did not cut the birds in two. And when the birds of prey came down upon the carcass, Abram drove them away. As the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram, and lo, a dread and great darkness fell upon him. When the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking firepot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, To your descendants I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates.
At that very hour, some Pharisees came and said to him, Get away from here, for Herod wants to kill you. He said to them, Go and tell that fox for me. Listen, I am casting out demons and performing cures today and tomorrow, and on the third day I finish my work. Yet today, tomorrow, and the next day I must be on my way, because it is impossible for a prophet to be killed outside of Jerusalem. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. See, your house is left to you. And I tell you, you will not see me until the time comes when you say, Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord.
They say there are two kinds of people in the world. Those who divide the world into two types of people, and those who don't. In general, I'm not a real big fan of binary thinking, believing that everything can be divided into two opposing and opposite camps. It's gotten us into a lot of trouble over the years. Either you're with us or you're against us. I either love you or hate you. It's either black or white, Republican or Democrat, righteous or evil, saved or damned, right or wrong. Binary thinking, or as Brother Richard Rohr calls it, dualistic thinking, tends to put us into these ever-shrinking categories, putting us over and against others. Seeing everyone and everything that is different from us as an adversary and an enemy. And it seems like every time we come up with a new category, our own tribe gets smaller and smaller and smaller until there's nobody here but me. Good thing I'm right. That said, there are times when binary thinking can help us to gain some clarity when our vision is a little fuzzy. Literally, as when your optometrist, you know, flips those slides when you've got that monstrous mask on your face, and she asks, which is clearer, one chunk or two chunk? And you go, could you do that again? One chunk or two chunk? And then you end up with bifocals. There's a graphic artist that I found online this week that looked at ways there are two kinds of people in the world that I thought was kind of cute. Could you show us a few of those slides? We got your cat people and your dog people. We have the right and the wrong way to eat chocolate bars. The right and the wrong way to eat your Skittles. Apple and Android people. So there are, sometimes binary thinking can help us out, giving some clarity and being able to figure out where certain things are. But generally, I find it gets us in trouble because it oversimplifies things. Jesus, we see in the Gospels, is generally against binary thinking as well. You see over and over again where an adversarial group comes up to Jesus to try to trap him between two opposite possibilities, but trap him between a rock and a hard place, a damned if you do and a damned if you don't answer. And he always came up with a third option that would turn their dualistic worldview upside down, or maybe sideways would be more accurate. But once in a while, Jesus does use a binary illustration to show some clarity, like your optometrist does, and like in today's reading. Jesus says that there are two ways to live in the world. There's the way of the fox, and there is the way of the hen. Now, in this reading, Jesus is on his way from Galilee to Jerusalem, from the land of one of the Herod brothers to the land of the other Herod brother. And a group of Pharisees, who are often depicted rather unfairly in the Gospels as Jesus' constant adversaries, actually come here as friends to warn their fellow rabbi that Herod, the puppet king of Judea, wants Jesus as dead as he wanted John the Baptist dead. And we know what happened to John the Baptist. He had his head on a platter. So they come to him and say, get away from here, man. Herod wants to kill you. In his reply to the Pharisees, Jesus comes about as close to using profanity as we hear in the Gospels. You go and tell that fox a thing or two for me. I grew up in the 70s when fox was a good term. Hey, she's a fox. Foxy lady. I never used that term, I swear. Never did. But I hear it was in the culture. But it was an ugly, ugly insult in Jesus' day. To a Jewish person, a fox was unclean, was a carrion eater, was sly and unscrupulous, an opportunist of an animal who killed seemingly for the fun of it. And my dad, who raised chickens in Kansas, would absolutely agree with that way of looking at foxes. The way of the fox was the way of Herod. It was the way of Pilate. It was the way of Caesar. It was the way every leader who uses the threat of violence over others, leaders whose tools are bullying, fear, force, power, and pragmatism. And then Jesus brings up this contrasting animal metaphor, this time for himself, the mother hen who yearns to protect her chicks in the safety of her wings. Now, I have to say that for me, this is not the most awe-inspiring of metaphors. A chicken? Episcopal priest Barbara Brown Taylor agrees with me here. She wrote, "Given the number of animals available, it is curious, she says, that Jesus chooses a hen. Where is the biblical precedent for that? What about the mighty eagle of Exodus? Or Hosea's stealthy leopard? What about the proud lion of Judah mowing down his enemies with a roar?" That was good enough for C.S. Lewis, right? Can you imagine Aslan being a chicken? The movies would not have been nearly as cinematic, is that the right word? Compared to any of those, a mother hen does not inspire a lot of confidence. No wonder some of the chicks decided to go with the fox. But a hen is what Jesus chooses, which, if you think about it, is pretty typical of him. He's always turning things upside down so that children and peasants wind up on top while kings and scholars land on the bottom. He's always wrecking our expectations of how things should turn out by giving prizes to losers and paying the last first. I'm trying to imagine Donald Trump in the audience watching this and going, "Losers." So of course Jesus chooses a chicken, which is about as far from a fox as you can get. So that way the options become very clear. Here's where Jesus, in a rare instance, becomes dualistic and binary. You can live by licking your chops, or you can die protecting the chicks. And Jesus chooses for himself to be the mother hen. The theme for today is connecting our stories with the biblical stories. To be a little bit more scholastic, connecting our narratives to the biblical narrative. For me, my story really began to intersect with the biblical story when, ironically, I left church, which is something most of us probably have to do at some point in our lives. I began to move away from the unhealthy portrait of God that I was fed as a teenager and moved toward a portrait of God that Jesus painted with his life and his death. A move away from God, the perpetually sour and displaced king, the God ready to roast all his wayward children save for the kind word of Jesus to stave off the well-deserved punishment, toward the heartbroken God who calls and cajoles, who woos his beloved children toward living and loving like this rabbi from Nazareth. A God who looks like Jesus. A God who does not choose the strongest or the bravest or the biggest or the most righteous, but a God who will strengthen and heal and empower the broken people who hear the call of God. I can't begin to describe how scared I was when I left the Fox Lake Baptist Church at 16 or 17. They were the people who were right. And they told me I was wrong. And It was really hard. I mean, I was a teenager, and so, yeah, I was angry, and I was resentful, and I was showing the smug superiority of an adolescent who feels they've been wronged by a bunch of hypocrites. I'm sure I was insufferable. But more deeply, I felt wounded by a church who said that my questions were outside the accepted boundaries. And I felt this deep down fear that I had disappointed not just the people in my parents' church, but I had disappointed God, and that my soul was in jeopardy. And what if their portrait of God was right? I say that my story began to intersect with the biblical story because that's when I started to read the Gospels on my own. I began to read the biblical narrative on my own, and I began to realize that they didn't share a lot of stories about, or the stories of Jesus. They like to talk about Jesus, but they actually didn't teach a whole lot of what Jesus taught. And I sat down one weekend and read the Gospel of Luke in a new translation that, instead of having the Bible columns that made it feel like you were reading from a textbook, was just, it doesn't sound radical nowadays, but back then it was wild to just have a single page of text running around. And it read like a novel. Oh my gosh. It was a portrait of Jesus I'd never seen. One who I was not scared of, but I found profoundly attractive. Someone who also was told that he was outside the accepted boundaries of religious behavior. I read about a God who calls us and chooses us and also gives us freedom not to choose. A God who was vulnerable as Jesus was to those who killed him. A mother hen. I'm going to quote Barbara Brown Taylor again. She wrote, "If you have ever loved someone you could not protect, then you understand the depth of Jesus' lament over Jerusalem. All you can do is open your arms. You cannot make anyone walk into them. And meanwhile, this is the most vulnerable posture in the world. Wings spread, breast exposed. But if you mean what you say, then this is how you stand." And for Jesus, this was how he was killed. Wings spread like a mother hen. My story moved toward the biblical story because I moved toward this God who woos, who calls, who loves, who equips, who sends, and away from the God silently stewing in simmering anger and disappointment. I'm going to ask you to be a little vulnerable here. I want you to think for a couple of minutes. It's always awkward to have 2 minutes of silence in a church. But to think of some of the stories in Scripture. And there are gajillions, so it may be hard. In your bulletin, I put a few of dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of calls of God calling people. But are there stories that you find intersect with yours or connect to you in a deep way? Maybe you identify with one of the characters. Maybe what happens mirrors or reflects something that's happened in your life. Is there a place where you see, you're able to see your life represented or framed or shown in a biblical story? I invite you to think about that for a couple of minutes. And if you found a story that connects to you, think about this in light of the story. The world is broken. And each of us is broken. And when God calls us, God starts to work in us and with us. And as God works in us, we learn that we can be a part of what God is doing in the world to heal the world. God is healing my fear and my indifference, and somehow I can be a part of healing a fearful and indifferent world. Think for a moment about how God is working in you, even using your most broken places to be about healing the world. And then I'm going to ask if you feel comfortable to turn to a person close by and share what you can, share what is safe of your story and how it connects to the biblical story. And each of you take a turn of a minute or two. Are there any stories folk would feel okay with sharing with the rest of us? Sorry?
It stays within the fuse.
It stays in the fuse. There are lots of call stories in the Bible, and very few of them are superheroes. All of them are broken. Most of them began with a, "No, not me, anybody else." But God called, wooed, strengthened, equipped, picked up, dusted off, helped to begin again. We are our stories. And I mean that about as literally as one can say. We all carry stories in us, and some of them are healthy and some of them are not, and they define so strongly who we are. Sometimes that narrative was written for us by other people. And sometimes it's not a very healthy narrative. Whether it might have been parents, or a teacher, or a church, or a lover. Who might have given you a narrative that says, I'm not worth loving. I'm not good enough. I'm not strong enough. Or if you behave, if you do these things, then I will love you. If you meet my expectations, then I will love you. And if you don't, then I'll leave. Or if you don't, I'll send you away. The narrative of God that is in us also informs us for good or ill. Narratives of a God who is just waiting for you to screw up once so he can pounce and devour. But we're also given narratives. I pray you've been given a narrative that says you are beloved, just as you are. Yeah, you're messed up. Join the club. Yeah, you're broken. Get in line. But you are beloved and deserving of love. So much of the counseling I do over the years with folk is helping people write their own narratives over a dysfunctional or broken one. And that's a lot. That's a lifelong work. And helping people rewrite the narrative of God in their lives. That's why I encourage people to read the Gospels, to see there a portrait of a God who is Mother Hen. You see in there the portrait of a God who calls each of us despite our brokenness and shows us step by step what it is like to put flesh and blood on us. We are a living gospel. We are a living narrative. And we all fall short. And that's the beautiful part. Broken, flawed, vulnerable people like you and me are invited to be the hands and feet of Jesus, who loves us exactly as we are and yet loves us way too much to let us stay that way. And I know it's hard, and we saw it here today, but other people need to hear that narrative. It's great for you to show it in acts of kindness and compassion and love, but sometimes people need to know what's the story underneath it. And being able to share that is vulnerable and hard and might save somebody's life. So, beloved, fellow beloved children of God, share who you are and share whose you are. Because you may be the only gospel someone meets. So be the good news.